Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Today is episode 74 of Feast Your Ears, and I'm very pleased to have Theo Peck from Peck's Homemade in the studio with me to talk about all things Peck's. Theo and I met years ago, I believe at a casserole cook-off. Is that right, Theo?
That is true. You were one of the judges.
Yes, and Theo and his partner in crime took first place, if I remember correctly, in that cook-off. I like to think that I played a small part in his speedy ascension to food stardom here in Brooklyn.
People have called it a rocket launch. Yes.
Welcome to the show, Theo. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was a long time ago, that casserole cook-off.
It was. It came at quite a crazy time in my life. I'm not sure you knew this, but before that casserole competition, I actually lost all my money in Madoff.
Wow.
So I was girlfriend, now my wife at the time, had told me to maybe get off the couch and stop looking depressed all day. And I found this competition you might love. It's a casserole. So everything changed after that.
Awesome. So is that why you answered my question? I do a bunch of pre-show questions about who you'd like to have dinner with, Madoff being one of those people.
Yeah, I'd be interested to talk to him. I mean, I'm not sure if I'd be interested to talk to him before or after, you know, everything came crumbling down. But it is an amazing kind of a sociopath, or I guess psychopath personality that, you know, affected not just me, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in a variety of ways.
Absolutely. Well, and the repercussions of those who weren't affected directly within the market and within a lot of other things too.
Well, you know, when you answered that question, I was talking to my friends and I was like, does the person actually have to want to talk to me too? Like, you know, like when you want to have dinner with somebody, that's like, you know, I mean, I studied art history. Do I want, like, if I talked with Mark Rothko, would he be like,
sure,
he's a depressed old Jewish man. Like, does he care if I and buy him some borscht, you know what I mean? So it was kind of one of those things. So, but if he was willing, yeah, it'd be something I'd be interested in.
You could watch Rothko just, like, paint with the sour cream through the borscht, though. That might be kind of cool.
To be honest, it would look very similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you got off the couch, stopped being depressed.
Yes.
Won a casserole competition.
Correct.
Tell me about the intervening years between then and now, with Peck's having established itself on Myrtle Avenue, and now you have a new location coming up.
Yes, a new location located at 49 Willoughby, between Claremont and Adelphi. The reason, you know, it's kind of hard to make it about those intervening years, right?
Sure.
Because previous to that, I was in the restaurant industry my whole life. My family had a restaurant called Ratner's, which to many people of the Jewish faith is a name that I can use for entree into the world of Judaism.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember.
Exactly. I've gotten a lot of free food and a lot of free stuff based on that. And so I grew up in the restaurant industry. And, you know, I like to say, even though I tried to get out of it, it pulled me back in. I guess part of why I liked it so much was that my aunts used to, like, drink scotch all the time in the back starting at 11 o'clock and just make fun of customers and have a good time and kibitz. And I would just love, you know, being there. We'd go 2-3 times a week for soup and all sorts of stuff. And what happened is after I studied art and found that to be an incredibly lucrative field, I switched and I opened up a bar in the Lower East Side called Lansky Lounge. And then, sometimes I think that if I had lost all my money and I wasn't in the food business, there's no way I would come back.
Right.
So then after that, I and did a variety of things. So right before Madoff, I was about to open a restaurant. I'd gone to culinary school. I'd cooked at some restaurants, and I actually had signed a lease. So it was this kind of devastating moment where what I liked about the competitions, one, the elation of when you win, and that started giving me more and more confidence to get back out there, to get back out. Because when something like that happens, there's a real tendency to shut the blinds, sure, and close the door and just be like, you know, I'll see you in 30 years. But thankfully, my wife was very good. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, the restaurant business, especially in New York, is nothing if not risky. And having this thing happen, I can totally imagine that would make you really risk averse.
You know, it's funny. Like, when I... So many things had to happen, right? So when I open... I mean, I go back to this real quick. When I opened the bar, what I think about is how many things actually had to happen and go right in society for this bar to succeed. One, you know, being there right before the Lower East Side took off, right?
Sure.
Two, having the space and having the cachet of being, you know, the back room of an old school Jewish restaurant. And then having swingers come out right as we're opening. Now, you know, you might think back to swingers. What I think about is they go to this bar behind a Jewish restaurant. And all of a sudden, we had opened a bar behind a Jewish restaurant. Right. And, you know, swingers was a kind of a cultural phenomenon.
Yep.
And next thing you know, people were just pouring in. And, it, you know, there are just a lot of things that happen. And so, you know, I don't necessarily, I'm just not a risk-averse person. I don't think things are that risky. I just assume that they'll work out, especially in this industry. So, you know, I'm opening this new place. And
by the way, I have to say, mm-hmm. I think when I ran into you and you told me the name of it, I just thought it was genius. I'll let you say it on the air, but mm-hmm. I just like it's the name is a phrase or a word or an idea that my grandmother and my mother used to use.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, when you look at my name, right, Peck, it's kind of a popular name. It, oddly enough, I started making merchandise, and all these Pecks from around the world, I'm now shipping merchandise around the world with the name Peck on it. They're just like, I didn't think that would be so amazing. Today we just sent something to Germany, a whole box of Pecks.
For someone whose last name is also Peck.
Yeah, and the founder of this German print press was actually Theodor Peck back in 1921. Anyway, so we went through a list of names, right? There was, you know, so my last name's Peck. What could the second place be called? You know, Peckerhead, and, you know, Peckstein, Peckowitz. And we finally ended up on Peckish, which maybe I should have called the first place Peckish. I kind of like it that much.
Sure.
But at first I was thinking, you know, your name, stand behind your name. But this the reason also we call it Peckish is because it's like a smaller version, less
right.
complicated.
Yep.
You know, so.
Same idea though. A place where you can come in, you can grab coffee, you can grab a sandwich, you can, you know,
you can
get an egg sandwich.
There's going to be a slight difference. So it doesn't have a. We're going to be making everything at Peck's and bringing it over. So,
got it.
But we're going to have a whole different menu, as a matter of fact, which I think is going to be based on the fact that we've been open a couple of years and now we have some idea of, and we have enough staff, right? You can go in a different direction and go with a little bit more. Not finesse, but a little bit more in an area you're interested in.
Yeah.
So the food will be slightly different, but definitely baked goods. A lot of, you know, we'd be making homemade bialys and, you know, gravlax and putting that together and doing a different, like, llama bread, you know, with, like, creme fraiche and onions and eggs, right? And, you know, just really going with that kind of a little bit more flavorful approach that, you know, at Peck's we kind of went with this kind of... you know, my background kind of being Jewish New Yorker, this is going to be slightly different. And the one thing is we don't have a kitchen there. So even though our egg sandwiches are one of our big components, there we're going to be making, I guess you'd say, different portable versions of egg.
Sure.
Because, you know, we need our eggs. And it'll be a lot more of a vibe place. It'll be, you know, much more seating, indoor seating. A lot. We're trying to find that mix of someplace you can hang out and relax and, you know, not necessarily do work, which I love. I got enough outlets, all that, don't get me wrong. But a place where at 10 o'clock you want to meet someone and hang out, that's where you're going to go.
Cool. And when is that opening?
That's a great question, Harry. The industry's great. I mean, maybe I'm not risk averse, but I definitely know how to find people to take their time when building their places out. You know, we like to call them, I guess, careful. I don't know if you're listening out there. I hope you're hearing me. You know what? I've said 2 to 3 weeks now for about 2 to 3 months. So
it was just an article, I think yesterday or the day before, comparing our current sitting monarch, I mean president, to a bad contractor.
Oh my God!
Because he says 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. About everything, and it was from the point of view of someone who'd had a horrible contractor like renovating their house when they were pregnant, and they like needed the baby's room done, and they had no water, and the contractor was saying 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks.
I know, and you're just like, yeah, it's gonna be 2 weeks, because I'm looking at this, I got no belief in this. So we started actually doing some of the work ourselves, Kyle and myself.
I've been there.
Yeah, but I now have some confidence. I know that there's some people out there who actually. You can hear it, maybe faintly in the distance. There's a miter saw or something going on, but I know something's being literally cut today that will be installed. So when I say
so, there will be progress.
Yes, there is real progress. Yeah. The problem is it lines up with July 4th. So I figure we have to open up after July 4th, yeah. But then we'll be good to go. And then, phase two.
So, it's clear to me that a lot of the inspiration behind what you do at PEX comes out of your sort of New York Jewish background. And to me, there's a lot of things about that it's like comfort food. You know, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, you know, comfort food, they think mac and cheese, they think, you know, sort of the American staples, barbecue, fried chicken, that kind of stuff. But, you know, for me, when I see on your Instagram, like a black and white cookie and borscht, and matzo ball soup, like that's the comfort food that used to be when I was a kid. I mean, I grew up north of the city, but when we would come into Manhattan, we would go and like we always got a black and white cookie. Mm-hmm. Or we went to the Lower East Side and we stopped by Russ and Daughters and we went to Katz's and we went to Kosar's for Bialy's, and like those kinds of things were always very comfortable. And I felt like when I moved to Brooklyn in 99, those things were still around. But they were starting to kind of disappear a little bit. You didn't, like, I feel like you don't see a black and white cookie, at least not a good one, all over the place like you used to.
Well, no, it's a very big challenge. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of times, right, I grew up in New York my whole life. I'm a New Yorker. You know, the Lower East Side in the 70s and 80s and even 90s, for that matter, you know, is really just the story of a neighborhood in flux. You know, the Jews were leaving, you know, the Dominicans moved in. And that obviously brings in a different audience,
yeah.
Right? And so if you think about all that food is like was concentrated down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ratner's had a lot of difficulty keeping up with that. You know, they had this huge bakery, but, you know, they didn't necessarily want black and whites. They want something different, the customers.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Jewish customers maybe living in Long Island, maybe up north, would come in, what, once every 2 weeks?
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it did make it more challenging. And I think that for me, growing up in that neighborhood, I always, you know, as I said, it's like the matzo ball soup, the borscht, that, pierogies even. They were not just comforting, but they were comforting because they were served with a side dish of my family.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I really like about this business, which is besides the long hours and the poor pay, is the fact that we all sit around and we bullshit all day. And I love that. And that's, to me, I need the black and white with a side of bullshit. Or yeah. Like, and there's nothing wrong with bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's part of life. I think I could not imagine God bless my wife, she works in an office, right? That, you know, it's not cubicles, but it's very quiet in there. I visited her and I'm like, oh my God, I couldn't imagine. You know, it's so quiet. It's like, yeah. Oh, you can hear a pin. So from my perspective, I really, the comfort food is so attached to that. It's very hard for me to see the matzo ball soup without seeing my aunts. And, you know, back then you could, like, smoke cigarettes and
right.
Do all sorts of weird stuff. And, I mean, like, they would just go up and, you know, take onion rolls out of people's purses and, like, you know, make rosé wine by mixing white and red wine. It was just one of those places that, so for me, the comforting elements of it, of the food are also, and I think that a lot of people maybe feel the same way. Like, comfort food, it's hard to eat comfort food alone in front of your TV watching Netflix. Like, I think that I mean, I maybe have tried that, of course, eating fried chicken in front of Netflix or like black and white or borscht, but it doesn't feel the same for me.
Yeah.
So it, to me, it's a bigger picture.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to say the old days were better. You know, I think one of the exciting things about living in the city is that state of flux. And like, it's great that you can go in the Lower East Side now and you can get roast pork and you can get rice and beans and you can get all that stuff. I guess for me, it's just, it's nice to know that there are still those places, you know, and that you can go to PEX and you can get a black and white, or you can get an egg sandwich, or you can get a, you know, a really great espresso drink that didn't exist in the 70s on the Lower East Side.
No, I mean, I mean, something, you know, PEX has really transformed over the 3 years we've been open. You know, when I first opened, I thought this would be some kind of like, you know, Jewish food center. Like everything would have to somehow touch on that part of my life, you know, that Jewish part of my life. And just like Ratner's did, because these restaurants did serve their community, their surrounding community, which was 100% Jewish at the time, obviously they would make that. You know, so what I did is slowly my menu started changing. Slowly there was more of an emphasis on the coffee and the egg sandwiches and things that were more for the parents or, you know, the people moving to the neighborhood who maybe were from Michigan or San Francisco or from France. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't like a black and white cookie or a well-done borscht or well-done. I mean, a lot of non-Jews love beets.
Yeah.
But, you know, it definitely affected the way I changed the menu for that whole reason. I think, as you can imagine, you know, that's one of the disappointing things is that Ratner's never really changed for the times.
Yeah.
You know, they really tried to stick it out, and they had a 200-seat restaurant, so you can imagine. That's, you know. It's tough, but...
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to take a short break and hear from our friends at Bob's Red Mill, one of our sponsors here at Heritage Radio. And when we come back, I want to talk about a different soup than your borscht. I want to talk a little bit about matzo ball soup.
This is Cynthia, host of Primary Food, here with Anna Bonengel, a registered dietitian with Eat With Zest, eatwithzest.com, and we are here to talk about Bob's Red Mill and superfoods. So, Anna, what is a superfood anyway?
One way to think about it is if you think of foods along a spectrum, there are a few foods with fewer nutrients, and then there are foods that are packed rich with nutrients and antioxidants. And so superfoods are those that are on the furthest on the scale in terms of having the most nutrients and antioxidants.
Which foods are considered superfoods?
Some are super well-known, like blueberries, kale, salmon. But now people are also going nuts over lesser-known foods like goji berries, acai, flax, and chia seeds. And a really popular one now is black garlic.
So if I'm trying to eat better, should I go on a strictly superfood diet?
Well, you know, superfoods are, of course, great, and I will say the more you eat, the better. However, eating only superfoods would make you deprived of essential nutrients from nourishing food groups like whole grains.
Okay, got it. Well, that's great, because our sponsor at HRN, Bob's Red Mill, produces a lot of delicious whole grain products.
You know, to be honest, I'm a huge Bob's Red Mill fan. I love a lot of the whole grains that they provide, but I particularly love they've come out with a blueberry hazelnut oatmeal cup. That is totally delicious. It's got classic superfoods like blueberries, but also some of the more trendy ones like flax and chia seeds. It's a really nice mix of trend and tradition.
Bob's Red Mill doesn't chase fads. They just keep working hard to offer as many delicious whole grain and organic food options as possible in an endless commitment to good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and today I have Theo Peck from Peck's Homemade and soon to open Peckish in the studio. Before the break, we were talking about Jewish food and borscht and some other stuff. I'm going to read the head note from Mimi Sheridan's recipe for chicken soup from her book From My Mother's Kitchen, which came out in 79. It's a recipe I made this week. My wife was sick and wanted some chicken soup, so I turned to this book. You know, I feel I've made a lot of chicken soup in my life. I kind of have an idea of usually how I make it, but it's fun to pull out somebody's recipe and sort of read what they put in it. And in this case, I love her head note for it, so I'm going to read it. As might be expected in a Jewish family, this was the soup of soups, panacea for all ills, whether physical or emotional, and to my mother at least, the measure of a cook's ability. She can't even make a decent plate of soup, my mother would say of a woman she considered not only a bad cook, but a totally worthless individual in all other aspects. It was always a plate of soup, and she was always self-congratulatory about her own. Each time she served it, she announced to all assembled that this was the best she ever made. Never did I hear her say that last week's excelled this week's, or that she was disappointed with the result. Only in recent years did she realize how difficult it is to make really good chicken soup with the chickens one has to work with today. For soup, more than any other dish, the degree of flavor in a chicken is critical. Naturally fed chickens, which were allowed to scratch and which were then killed to order and bled to death, the kosher method of killing, did actually produce lighter, clearer, more golden soup of more delicate flavor. It is still possible to get chickens killed to order that way, even though the chickens are not nearly as good as their ancestors. Still, every little bit helps. Above all, do not expect to make good soup with frozen chicken or any variety other than a fowl, which requires long, slow cooking and so imparts whatever flavor it has to the soup. If you do get a fresh-killed chicken, order it 48 hours before you intend to cook it, so it will be tender. Mm. So this was 79 when they were already lamenting bad chickens. I feel like we're kind of in a middle ground now. I feel like good chickens are sort of coming back. I once went to the live poultry market when I was in my early 20s. I was biking. I used to bike past a live poultry market in Queens all the time. And one day on my way home, I stopped and I was like, oh, I'm just going to get chicken to cook. Mm. Little did I understand that when you buy a live chicken at a live poultry market, you're buying it whole, not dressed. So they're like, how big do you want? And I was like, I don't know, 4 pounds. So I got this chicken that, like, after they took off the feathers and the head and the feet and the guts and everything out, it was, like, tiny. But it did make really good soup, as it turned out. So your matzo ball soup has won many accolades at PEX, and it is a chicken soup.
It is a chicken soup. It's you're right. The chickens are coming back in a sense. You know, the access to better chicken is a lot better these days. And I do understand the lamenting. You know, I don't. It is kind of odd to see the Dolly Partons, as they call them, on the Purdue chicken. You know, where they can't walk. And it's I realize you love breast meat. but you know. I guess growing up, I was very fortunate. My mom was a chef, independent of Ratner's, and you know we used to really have a lot of the thighs. You know, it was always dark meat. And so, my mom would make a lot of chicken soup growing up. And what she would do is she would make the broth twice, so to really concentrate the flavor. And in the second one, she would add chicken feet. So in our second stock, there's basically almost half a case of chicken feet per batch of chicken stock that we use. And what that does is it not only gives it that golden flavor, but it gives it the viscosity or that mouthfeel that I think a good chicken soup should have. It kind of coats the mouth. It doesn't feel watery.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things, like when you have like these canned soups or chicken soups, it feels like you're drinking water.
Yeah.
And it could have the flavor, right?
Yep.
But then it's just kind of feels like bouillon.
Yeah.
And to really get that chicken flavor, I really like to not only use a ton of carcass and backs and necks, but then we, as I said, we finish it with feet. And that just gives it the mouthfeel that I think people at the end of the day, that's what they're psyched about. That's why it's getting the accolades.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And later in the recipe and the instructions, Mimi Sheridan talks about actually quartering the chicken so that you can use less water. So you're not putting a whole chicken, like many old chicken soup recipes say, that you're covering with water. So you can actually make that stock richer because you're using less water to meat sort of and bone ratio.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was always surprised at, you know, when you come up in the culinary world, there's so many ways people are making chicken stock.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, somebody at one place I was at, you know, the guy ran the chicken through the dishwasher. Without soap. You know, it would be like that quick sterilization. And yeah. I guess he also felt he was from the Thomas Keller School. So the chicken, like what I didn't appreciate about when I would do chicken stock at this one restaurant was the fact that it was too clean. I felt like, you know, part of chicken soup. And if we're going to be talking about something that feels family and something that feels like you're with people, I think a sense of dirtiness is fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so we don't do that method. We don't, like, you know, put it through a dishwasher or anything like that. And we, you know, there's a kind of emphasis, like, we'll strain it a couple times, make sure everything's out, you know. But outside of that, no, that's one of the things I found that was happening is a lot of people would try to make this incredibly clean, idealized $400,000 chicken stock, which you don't need. It's just appreciate the soup. There's some of the big matzo ball in there. There's chicken. There's carrots. There's maybe some noodles. Are you a fan of matzo ball soup and noodles or no noodles?
In my family, we never. It was one or the other. You either had, like, on my dad's side. I think it was my dad's side. You know, there were dumplings, so it was chicken soup with dumplings, which really, I mean, is a pasta dough that you're then cooking. They're not like dumplings the way we might think of them in our Asian obsessed food climate of the moment.
I went to school in the South. I've had chicken dumpling soup.
You know, and this, but or there was matzo balls. We were never really like a chicken noodle soup. But
really?
And very rarely were there ever noodles with matzo balls.
See, growing up, I mean, maybe that's why I look the way I do, Harry. I mean, it was noodles and matzo balls, you know what I'm saying? I like a chunky style, you know?
So this brings up sort of a tangential question that I have. I had a discussion recently with someone about the fact that sometimes now, you know, with the proliferation of the, I guess, return to real butcher shops where you can go in, you can talk to a butcher, you can get the cut that you want. Often when you buy a chicken in that setting, it does not come with giblets and the neck. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was always a big part of having a chicken, whether you're making chicken soup or whether you're making roast chicken, was that while you're cooking it, you got a little snack. Because you got to cook the liver with some onions and you get out the crackers, and that was like always like that was always the, you know, for to put a highfalutin word on what it was, because my grandmother would, it was the amuse for the dinner.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine doing that for my son today. I think he would. I think he would be like, "What? I thought I was getting crackers as an amuse." It's interesting because what I really like to do is I like confiting all the stuff that comes out. I like taking the heart and the gizzards and, you know, packing in salt and cooking in fat and make a salad out of it. It's one of my favorite things to do. And actually, one of the more shocking things I had to do is I was working in a restaurant that also was on a farm, and I remember there I killed my first bird. It was actually a turkey, but I think close enough to the chicken. And, you know, first of all, killing it was incredibly disturbing. I don't know if I can do it again. But then I was in charge, as I worked the butcher department, I was in charge with gutting them. And when you get a chicken, even with the giblets and stuff, you're not really prepared for cutting a hole in the bird, and then you pull out the entire, like,
all the rest of it that we don't ever see.
Lungs and all sorts of grass that he's been eating. And I was just, took me a while actually to get back to chicken after that. I was a little put off.
It's intense. That same, my father's grandmother, they kept chickens when my dad was a kid. His grandmother lived with them, and all of her recipes started with, first you kill a chicken. Because what they would do, and it was she would go out and she'd kill the chicken, and then they would make whatever they're going to make out of it,
like ice cream.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. but yeah, no. I mean, unfortunately, living in New York City, you know, I never had that connection to food that you probably did growing up north. You know, my connection was always there was a waiter between me and the food. You know, I mean, there was never a I don't think the 70s, except on Sesame Street, did I really see a farm.
Yeah, I mean, we would stop at farm stands for sure. That was definitely a big thing we would do. You know, but like most good, like, late 70s, early 80s families, you know, we used margarine instead of butter. You know, we ate cereal out of boxes. Like, it was not, you know.
By the way, how did the soup turn out?
The soup that I yeah. made. Oh, it turned out it was delicious.
Is your wife better?
She is, in fact. So yeah, I mean, it works. You know, panacea for all ills. I mean, Jewish penicillin, as mm-hmm. they call it, right?
Yeah, that and a good swift kick, I guess. Yeah,
I mean. Yeah, I mean, I wait. Usually, I save that if she doesn't get better.
Oh. Well, yeah, no, I hear you. I just actually beg that my wife gets better because I can't handle everything by myself. As she knows that there's just no way I can handle life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about something that you guys started doing, I believe, in January at mm-hmm. PEX, which is you have a wall where it's the what we're thinking about.
Yeah.
And every day, right, you post something that you're thinking about related to the political climate?
Well, for the first 100 days, we definitely had a, you know, I don't think it comes as any surprise that a New Yorker maybe didn't necessarily, a New Yorker who lives in Brooklyn didn't necessarily vote for Trump. You know, I grew up in an incredibly liberal Jewish household on the Upper West Side of New York. You know, we voted for Carter twice. And there's just wouldn't even be a thought. I've never really voted any other way. So having Trump come in was not just like maybe George Bush coming in. It was something. I mean,
It was a crushing blow, I think, to a lot of us.
It was nauseating.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt sick for weeks just getting up to his inauguration. And, you know, there's times where I still don't believe it. I just think that we're all going to wake up. But what we did is we started putting up what we're thinking about on the glass and, you know, looking for people to, you know, join a group that would, you know, be sympathetic. And it's not necessarily, we're not looking to do anything too crazy so much as to inspire others to make sure they make their phone calls or inspire others to make sure they take some action. You know, the hardest thing with... you're busy, you know, I'm very busy. The hardest thing, like right now, I have some resentment towards this government because now I got to work extra hard because now I feel like I've got a third job,
yeah,
which is to call my representative okay. and to try to make some, you know, and I think one of the hardest parts is that I think we all should feel when we look at our government, it's like, can we really make a change? Is my 5 phone calls working? Is this working? Is getting up at a town hall and screaming or going to a protest? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe we'll find out in a year if it does work. You know, my son has already been to 3 protests and he's only, you know, 5 plus.
Yeah.
I think I went to my first protest when I was 18. So it's a definite big change, right? You know, there's a lot of things going on and, you know, the wall was a way to try to focus our attentions, but also it became this idea of like what's really the most important, because for someone like us, you know, the state of schools, is this Betsy DeVos really a champion of public education? You know, I mean, you know, this is something that will maybe not today, but in time affect my life. You know, is Ben Carson, I mean, I don't live in assisted housing, but is Ben Carson really the best thing for society? Like, you know, there's all these fires to put out in the beginning. And now, I mean, there's still Pruitt and Sessions. I mean, we can go on and that doesn't even include the president and Comey. I mean, where do we begin?
Yeah.
And so the hardest thing was just, of that wall was just trying, as I said, to, you know, try to create a community because, you know, it's like I said, I stopped cooking stuff that I didn't think the community needed or wanted. They don't want Ratners. They want good food that they could just take home. Rotisserie chicken is perfect for them. Do you know what I mean? Or sandwiches. And it's the same with this, trying to talk to my community. And to be honest with you, we have a great number of regulars, which I'm sure you do. I felt like after we started doing the wall that we all got a little even closer. Like there was a lot more of that idea of like we're all in it together.
Yeah.
We even produced a sticker that, you know, we give away that says that we serve, I don't know, like all genders, races, religions, orientations, we just serve you all. I mean, that's what we're about. And if you've ever been, if you've ever been to Clinton Hill, which I'm hoping you have been, what I love about Clinton Hill is that it is truly one of the more diverse neighborhoods. It does remind me of like the Upper West Side when I was growing up in the 70s. Like, it was a very diverse neighborhood back then. Maybe not today, but it was. And the same with Clinton Hill, at least, you know, I feel like you can walk down the street and it's not Manhattan.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I also think that it's a strong choice. I know a lot of businesses don't get into politics because they take the view that they do serve everybody and they don't want to alienate customers. And I you know, obviously your the what we're thinking about wall does come from a partisan belief, but I feel like it's still presented in a way that it's not, you're not coming down on people who don't believe the same thing. You're just saying this is the thing we're thinking about as a business and that we could all be thinking about it no matter what side of it.
I mean, thank you. Yeah, I mean, you're correct. I mean, that is, you know, I mean, you know, my wife was really kind of instrumental and helped me think about it. And, you know, in the first couple of days I was thinking about it, I had all these things I was saying. And, you know, she was really strong. She was strongly telling me not to get too political, to really try to keep it, as you say, don't come down on me. I actually have friends who voted for Donald Trump. I mean, I do. And we did stop talking for a while. And, you know, now we're back to talking. And it's been a very rewarding experience for me because, you know, I was able to express to him why it was so frustrating in a polite way. And instead of just being like, you know, F this and fuck you. And, you know, look at what you brought down on me. You know, you know, we did at the time get a lot of anti-Semitic emails because we're a Jewish place. And, you know, that it's funny. I really did not feel this fear from the anti-Semitic emails. More of I just like, I don't know why. I just found it hysterical that this guy wasted his time to send me an email about turning myself into. I was like, really? Like, this is your, you spent like 10 minutes proposing this email. Like, what a waste of time.
Yeah.
I mean, at least I hope you're click and pasting it somewhere so you're sending it to more people. I mean, like, what are you thinking? So, you know, for me, I don't worry about that. I you know, we did have a customer who complained to me about it, who still comes in every day. And, you know, he said, you know, but, you know, the tax cuts, I love the tax cuts. By the way, that's an accurate impression. That's how he talks. I just want to emphasize that. He's like, I just want tax cuts. That's all. And I was like, well, look, man, there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
And you know, we had a great conversation, and he still comes in every day.
That's great.
We're not looking to insult anybody.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
But it's nice to, it's, you know, what it shows me as well, and that anecdote shows that you've created a place that is a part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as, and that, you know, it's not the same as a place that, you know, people are just so transient that they're just stopping in and mm-hmm. they're grabbing a coffee and they don't talk to anybody and they don't look around. So the fact is that you know, I mean, and obviously I'm sure you have customers like that who are like, oh, I need a coffee right now. Where's the closest coffee?
Yeah.
But, you know, you have people who are coming in, who are engaging with you, and it is a dialogue, and you are a part of the fabric of that neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, you know, also I think that what I've learned a little bit, you know, having grown up and, you know, having a place in Manhattan when I was growing up, you know, a couple of businesses in Manhattan that people would necessarily travel to, right? You know, there weren't, you know, you travel to Radnor's or you travel to my bar. But now we have a business where, you know, it's very specific for the neighborhood. And the people who come live within a certain area. What I've noticed is that these kind of businesses that you have, like the people who open these coffee and sandwich shops with meat and cheese, maybe a light grocery, what we do is you're really serving a finite community. And that's what's amazing about New York, because, you know, 10 blocks away, there might be something similar.
Right.
And that's fine. I mean, that's what it's. There are 8.5 million people in the city. I mean, we, you know, and not all live in Staten Island. Some live in Brooklyn. So, you know, that I think also makes it, because the people, the customers in my store, are coworkers and neighbors, And so even when you're sitting, when you're standing next to someone online, you're like, oh man, yeah, you live in 4B. Hey, how are you? And I think that's what helps make it a community place. Now, if people were, let's say, man, I got to drive all the way for this matzo ball soup and come here. I've got to drive all this way for a black and white. And the guy's like, yeah, I just drove all the way from Manhattan. Ugh, yeah. Just got to try this soup. Right. You wouldn't get the same response.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you. It's been a really fun conversation. We're out of time. Is there anything? So 2 to 3 weeks on Peckish, we think.
Yeah. Look, I'm gonna lay it out here. Let's promo this, right, Harry? Yeah. Let's talk about Peckish. It's gonna be at 49 Willoughby Avenue between Claremont and Delphi. I would start looking for it after July 4th weekend. If you have any questions, peckshomemade.com. Or just give the shop a call and ask for Kyle.
And you can follow everything that's going on in the social media realm at Peck's Food.
Yes.
You should check out their Instagram. It's a great mix of things from the shop. There's pictures of Theo's son. A lot of great stuff in there.
Yeah. And as I said, thank you very much for having me down here. I'm hoping to grab some pizza on the way out and make a day of it. Thank you, Harry.
Awesome. Well, thanks everybody for listening to Feast Your Ears. A big thank you to David Tatasciore for engineering the show every week. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. I have to make a shameless plug for my first book, which comes out August 1st. Vinegar Revival is a guide to making and using vinegar at home. You can pre-order it at vinegarrevival.com or on Amazon or from your local bookstore. Please take a moment to like the show on iTunes if you, in fact, enjoyed this. And please reach out to me if you have any questions. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com. You can follow me on social media, @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.